This week on Education Radio.
Many of us who have been around for a while underestimated, I think, the corporate interest. I think as the global market shrunk, you know, corporate interests, hedge funds, etc., found the public sector to be a yeasty, profitable center.
You got to tell the story of the old Civil Rights Movement and how the Little Rock Nine were youth high school students. The youth were very important in the Civil Rights Movement.
This is a really scary time where we really are considering. It was never on the table to privatize education in an explicit way. It is on the table now.
Welcome to Education Radio. I'm Deborah Polin.
And I'm Tim Sutton. Last week, we featured the voices and testimony from the historic Save Our Schools rally and march that took place in Washington, D.C. in July. We now continue our coverage of this event with reports from the conference leading up to the rally and march. This conference brought together hundreds of teachers, education scholars, youth, and activists from all over the country for 2 days of workshops and networking as a means to build a national movement to restore educator, parent, student, and community influence over education policy and practice. For this week's program, we feature several voices from the event, voices that relay, in the words of one of our interviewees, both stories of struggle and stories of hope. We hear from Michelle Fine, a faculty member at the CUNY Graduate Center in New York City, about the complicated ways that education reform is playing out within several New York City schools. We hear from a Detroit public high school student organizer who led student walkouts to protest the city's school closings. And finally, we hear from Sabrina Stevens Shoup, a former Denver public schools teacher and the public relations coordinator for Save Our Schools, who shares her story of being forced out of her teaching position for taking a stand against her principal's vision of school reform.
First, we hear from Michelle Fine, a faculty member at the CUNY Graduate Center in New York City, who has spent years working alongside politically marginalized youth to create spaces of empowerment. I sat down with Michelle at the Save Our Schools conference to talk with her about her experiences.
I was able to hear the session that you just finished, and there was a particular story that you told about the Frank McCourt School. It would be great to get from you maybe a couple of stories that you feel are emblematic of the current climate in education.
Yeah. So let me give you a couple of stories that I think reflect the dismantling and segregation of public education, but also stories of possibility and hope. The school I was just talking about, where I was studying how it is we produce large numbers of high school dropouts, or now pushouts, as though it were natural. And because the thing that was really striking about the work that I did for Framing Dropouts was I searched for the bad guys, right? In the very beginning, I was looking for who's the bastard who's throwing the kids out. And you know what? Everybody was kind of doing their job. In a machine of racism and capitalism and mass incarceration and underfunding public, you didn't have to be driven by evil to produce terrible outcomes. But what was important is at the end of the year, when I presented my research to the full faculty, and I said something like, you know, there are only 250 kids at graduation. If this were a white middle-class school, we'd all be outraged. And somebody said, you know, kind of, how dare you compare this school to my children's school? You know, these children are living in very different circumstances. And I thought, well, therein lies the problem. You don't need bad intent to reproduce race and class inequity. You do need very strong collective intent to reverse it. Right? So it doesn't take intentionality to make bad. It does take intentionality to make good. I returned to this building just 2 years ago because I heard that they were closing the school where I did this ethnography, which I've always called Comprehensive High School, CHS. But when it became public that they were closing it, I started referring to it by its God-given name, which was the Louis Brandeis High School on the Upper West Side. And I went because I read a little article in the newspaper indicating that they were closing Brandeis High School because it was a, quote, failing school. Now, mind you, 20 years before then, lots of us noticed that it was a failing school. but somebody had new designs on this building, and the neighborhood was gentrifying, and unfortunately the upper middle class community had now noticed that they would like to reclaim the building. That it's not unfortunate in and of itself, but they didn't want Brandeis High School. They wanted a redesigned school for the children of gentrification. And so they were closing Brandeis, presumably because of low test scores, high dropout, low graduation, and over-enrollment of underprepared kids who had been placed there by a system that had starved that school and punished it. Now that school was being punished, publicly humiliated, in the way that those school closings really kind of eat at your interior, as if it were those teachers producing those outcomes. So they were going to close it and reopen it as four small schools. One was a credit recovery school, which is something we do in New York when kids are overage and undercredited, and we don't want our dropout rate to look bad. We have these credit recovery schools, some of which are great, lots of which are scams. Then there were two what are called non-selective high schools, mostly low-income, Black and Latino, non-selective kids. Those schools were literally put together that August with teachers grabbed and scotch taped in. And then there was the Frank McCourt School for Journalism. And Frank McCourt was going to be the darling of the local community. It was designed in partnership with Symphony Space. And there were lots and lots of good thinking behind Frank McCourt. This was going to be what they called an integrated building, but not integrated schools necessarily. So the building would have racial diversity, but the schools would be relatively stratified. So I was at this community meeting, and we were talking about whether there'd be entrance criteria, selection criteria for Frank McCourt, and the people from the district explained that it would only be open to threes and fours. In New York City, children are basically tattooed on the soul if they are ones or twos or threes or fours, and threes and fours are the more academically achieving children who tend to be wealthier, who tend to be whiter, who tend to be from more middle-class homes. They tend to be English speakers. So the entrance requirement were going to be threes and fours, good attendance at your prior school, writing samples. Some of us raised our hand and said, well, what if a kid writes only in Spanish? No, we're going to need English. So it started to become clear that Frank McCourt was going to be a lovely, creamy school in the Brandeis building. And all I could do is think of the legacy of both Brandeis and McCourt. Men who fought for justice from a Jewish background and an Irish background, who understood the needs of immigrants and poor people. And so some of us said, well, wait a minute, this building has long betrayed the children of Central and East Harlem, and are we now saying that those kids won't have access? And they said, no, all children will have access. We're going to use what are called demographically neutral indicators, test scores, writing ability, and attendance records. Well, we know those aren't demographically neutral. Then somebody raised the question of the metal detectors at Brandeis and explained that our kids aren't going to go through metal detectors, which seems so apparent in the room. And then the woman facilitating the session said, well, no, our children probably wouldn't want to go through metal detectors, so perhaps we should use the rear entrance. And at that point, there was a kind of slippery discourse that in the past I've called an apartheid discourse, and somebody who does South Africa organizing said, don't use South Africa, we're actually doing fine. Call it an Upper West Side discourse. And this phenomenon is happening all over New York, where schools are being closed and then reopened, and charters or selective schools are moving in. Kids are using back doors. And in the Bronx, the way that's playing out is less by race, more by class, or the very poor aren't getting into the charter or selective schools. So that's one story. Another story is they started an academy of aviation and aeronautics or something at one of the multi-school building in Evander Childs High School. So the Academy of Aviation and Aeronautics also had selection criteria. School was almost all Black and Latino, low income. The kids in aviation aeronautics wore uniforms. They had laptops. They had the painted side of the building, and they tended to be immigrant. And so the tensions in the school now between those kids and the non-academy kids got really hot. And at one point they decided to do a project together, a research project about how has the presence of the academy changed the school. So they were doing it collectively. So I got to watch the movie they made. One boy said, you know, they wear all those uniforms, those aviation uniforms, so they don't go through the metal detectors anymore because they beep too much. He said, so it used to be that the metal detectors were to protect all of us from the streets, but now it feels like it's protecting them from us, right? Mm-hmm. And you could feel like, I'm this white middle-class Jewish woman, doesn't think about fighting a lot, but I thought, I want to beat them up. Like, this is so unfair. It just feels so intense. And then these poor little immigrant kids in their little uniforms who are beeping or carrying their laptops don't understand why local kids don't like them. So that's the scene we're in. And now so many schools have police. New York City Schools has the fifth largest police force in the country in the schools. So just interactions that would otherwise be disciplinary or joking or bad joking or attitude then accelerate to cases where kids are being taken out in handcuffs. And this will be my third Debbie Downer story. There's a school in the Lower East Side, a very sweet small school called Eastside Community High School. They use performance assessment. It's just a beautiful, beautiful, rigorous, inquiry-based school. The students had very close relations with the teachers. A young woman, a 12th grader, came to school early because she had to run upstairs and talk to her college counselor. And the security officer said, you can't go up, it's 9, 8 o'clock. She said, no, I have an appointment, I have to. And she said, you can't go up, it's 8 o'clock. She said, I gotta go, and she went up. So the security guard grabbed her and started to arrest her, at which point another kid ran upstairs and told Mark, the principal, Mark Fetterman, who's a god. And Mark came down and said, what are you doing? Wait, I should have told you. She was supposed to come up. And they said, well, we got to arrest her. We're going to take her downtown. And he said, well, let me follow you. And please don't walk her out front because there are 6th through 12th graders lined up. Don't perp walk her in front of the other kids. So don't take her out the front door, take her out the back door. These doors are political. They're in all of my stories, right? I didn't realize it. Take her out the back door. So that security officer agreed, but then she left and another officer came in. So they started to walk the girl out the front door. And Mark stood at the door. You can Google this story. It's just Eastside Community. And that security officer grabbed Mark, threw him on the floor, and they perp walked both Mark, the principal, and the girl in front of the kids. So that's happening on the one hand. And then on the other hand, in New York City, there are these amazing schools, about 36 of them, in the Performance Assessment Consortium, largely high schools, where teachers have gotten a waiver from the, we have 5 regents that kids have to pass in order to graduate, so they're content-based, discipline-based regents, English, social studies, global studies, science, math, something. That's a lot of work, right? And it's corrupted the curriculum. You can imagine teachers feel like they don't get to teach very creatively. They have to teach at the test. English language learners used to have relatively high graduation rates in New York, even if it took 6 years. But now that we have these high-stakes tests, they've taken a real dive. These 30-ish schools have waivers from the region, so the kids only have to pass the math and the language arts. And they're inquiry-based schools where they have performance-based assessment. They were started by Debbie Meyer and Ann Cook. And they're just stunning schools where, in order to graduate, kids have to do a rigorous history paper and defend it before a panel of a teacher, a student, a parent, and a university professor, or an English paper, or a science project, or an ethics project, or a math problem. And I'm often on those panels, and sometimes the papers are delicious, they're amazing, they're brilliant, and you think, oh my God, this is so great, just a regular kid. And sometimes they're mediocre, if not crappy. And then you say, honey, this is going to be a great paper, but you're not going to graduate in June, you're going to graduate in September, and you're going to learn how to write. And revision is just built into the curriculum. And So that's just a stunning, and you can go to these schools, and I feel like as a nation we've lost our imagination for how would we hold schools accountable in a way that was developmental for both students and teachers, right? And so these are amazing. And then Laurie Chaget did a dissertation following those kids from the performance assessment high schools into college. And there were three big findings. One is they're really disappointed in how college teachers teach because they're so spoiled by good high school teaching. They couldn't believe teachers stand with their backs to the class and just write on the board. The second is that they're not freaked out about writing. They know how to write, so they're so surprised that their roommate is like really nervous about some paper when they're not. The third is that they really know how to revise. So they know how to bring a paper to a teacher early and say, tell me what you think about this, which I have to say I only teach doctoral students, but my better educated students know how to get feedback from me early, and my less well educated students hand it in maybe on time, maybe a minute before, maybe a day late, no feedback. Well, the better educated kids have gotten rounds of feedback. So these kids really knew how to revise, and I have to say I feel like we should have, if we have national goals, the capacity to revise, take feedback, that's a goal. So they're writers, they know how to revise, and when they hit a bump in the road, they know how to trust adults and find one. Those are the three standards I think we should care about. And particularly for poor kids, they hit a bump in the road in college. They're like, I'm out of here. You know, my mom's sick. My brother's in jail. I got to go make money. I don't belong here anyway. You know, any moment becomes the exposure of shame. So these performance assessment schools are amazing. And the last story I will tell you is the work that we've done with youth participatory action research, training young people to be researchers of their own lives and what we call circuits of dispossession, the policies that deprive them of good education, healthcare, housing, human security, but also circuits of possibility and organizing. And we've been doing this all over New York with looking at, you know, some kids are looking at the impact of mass incarceration on children, and some are looking at educational opportunities, and some are looking at street harassment of girls. And Youth PAR, Youth Participatory Action Research, has been such a powerful experience of engaging young people, adults, elders, in interrogating the conditions of their lives. And when they then present these data to youth forums or conferences like this, people often say, isn't it depressing to study racism? And kids say, I knew about racism before I met, like, Michelle. But now I know that I have white allies. I know that it's not inevitable. I know there are things you could do back. I know I can name it. And one little girl said, you know, now when I watch TV with my mom, I no longer see flat, right? I explained to her, see that newspaper story, that news story? Well, let me explain what those stats mean. And really, there are corporate interests behind it. And the kids who are dropping out of school are showing up for these PAR projects because it takes so seriously the knowledge and expectations and expertise that they bring. And now, last thing I will say is that we have been performing the data around the country and most recently in Canada, where we train them in theater of the oppressed, but they perform the data, which is a technique that W.E.B. Du Bois used. He used to perform African-American history on the streets because so many people he wanted to connect with weren't literate.
So I think maybe we'll just wrap up with one final question, and that is, so, I mean, you've been engaged in activism of various sorts for decades, and so could you speak a little bit about this conference and the current climate in education activism within a larger historical context?
Yeah. Many of us who have been around for a while underestimated, I think, the corporate interest. I think as the global market shrunk, you know, corporate interests, hedge funds, etc., found the public sector to be a yeasty, profitable center. And in some ways, the crudest version of that was an article that was in the real estate section of an Ohio newspaper where a guy just wrote this article saying, you know,
I own a lot of apartment buildings in a really poor neighborhood. Nobody's going to live there for a while. Who's going to pay me rent? But then I heard about the charter law. Ohio is a very weak charter law. And so now I've set up three schools. I hired an education management organization to run it. I get $7,000 per kid. And you know, even if the schools don't work out, in 3 years the neighborhood will be gentrified. Well, in some ways he was just as honest, right? So these are really bad times. These are terrible times. It is easy to feel defeated. What I love about this conference is for people to come together to understand that it's that these issues are local, but they're also national, they're economically driven, and that there's really important fight back, and that there are parents fighting back and teachers fighting back and young people. And the thing that always amazes me is, for as long as I do this work, the desire to be well-educated is stunning. You know, I interview poor kids who have gone to crappy schools all their lives, and I say, what's your example of your favorite teacher? This is in California. And one little girl said, oh, the kind who, like, puts red marks all over my paper and then says, come on, I'm going to help you learn how to read and write better, and gives me books that I think I can't read and then helps me get there. And I think, or my own work in college and prison with women who have been told their entire lives they are not college material, watching them yearn to be educated. And so there's a little Frederick Douglass in me saying, wow, that's really cool. I know it's not, I know college isn't for all, and I know there aren't jobs, and I know there's still racism, and but actually the desire to learn is unbelievably high, and the desire to teach is unbelievably high. And so there's something very powerful about this conference, about bringing very differently positioned people who probably share values, maybe not strategy, reimagining what could be, even as we are fighting for a very degenerated version of what is, right? And I said at our last session, I'm a little tired of defending bad conditions because I'm worried that they're going to get privatized. We need to speak the ambivalence that we feel in our hearts. There are reasons that parents are gravitating toward charter schools, because what we've given them has not been good. There are also reasons now that parents are furious about charter schools because their kids are being thrown out or told that they're misbehaved or they have too many learning issues, and they realize, oh, this was just a scam. So we have an incredible number of allies, and I spent a lot of time reading how did people organize in the 30s, how did they work against the despair. And partly you need places like this, which are like intellectual and political spas for collective reunionizing.
That was an interview with CUNY Graduate Center faculty member Michelle Fine. This is Education Radio. Tabrin Joe is a senior from University High in Ferndale, Michigan. Since middle school, he has been an organizer for By Any Means Necessary, a primarily student and youth-led organization working to address issues of inequity, such as the dismantling of affirmative action and school closures. Tabrin talks with us about his work and what he thinks is necessary to keep this movement going.
My name is Tabrin Joe from Detroit, Michigan, Detroit BAM organizer, and BAM stands for the Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action, Integration, Immigrants' Rights, and Fight for Equality by Any Means Necessary. I'm a high school senior, working to defend public education.
There was a lot of talk in this session about how it's so important to have youth lead this movement. And as an organizer of your fellow youth, how do you do that?
Well, BAM and our BAM organizers, we go through class presentations. We work a lot with the teacher unions. We work a lot through going through the teachers, asking them to make presentations, speaking to them like we did today about coming and building the movement, how important the youth are in this moment. And once the students in their classroom hear from other youth and other students that BAM has recruited and they've became leaders, like, they're going to jump on the moment to, like, be a part of the movement.
What is one of the things that you're the most proud of that you've done in the maybe last year or so?
Well, the most proudest thing I've ever done was the I did when I was in middle school, because I joined in 2006, and that was about 6 years ago. In 2007, Detroit was facing school closures after school closures after school closures, and I organized a walkout, which my school was about 500 people, and like we demanded that there will be no school closings. we were willing to fight. We were willing to walk out, and we did walk out, and I've been with AM ever since then.
What initiated that for you? How did you get involved to begin with? What drove you to do that walkout, to organize that?
The year before that, we had the affirmative action case against Ward Conley, Jennifer Gratz, MCRI, which is the Michigan Civil Rights Initiative, and the ACRI, which is the National American Civil Rights Initiative. What they did was lie to people, say to get affirmative action on the ballot. This is for affirmative action, but it was totally against affirmative action. And they used voter fraud, what the civil rights movement fought for, to get the right to vote. But they used it against us, got on the ballot, got it voted for, and we lost affirmative action from there. But I'm glad to say that the Sixth Circuit Court in Cincinnati just ruled in our favor of affirmative action is back in play in Michigan because of the Sixth Circuit Court. And we still have to keep fighting because I talked to our attorney. This is a dog fight, and we're going to have to fight to the end, to the Supreme Court. We're willing to go all the way. And we're fighting in California. I know Prop 209, which passed while BAM was founded in 95. They're in the federal court there. So it's just like the Brown decision. Virginia, Kansas, it was all these different counties and school boards that they joined together, and they won in 54.
So how will you continue this fight? What's next for you?
I met teachers from New York, teachers from Florida, New Orleans, D.C. I just have to keep fighting to win, build BAM, keep talking to people, educating them about how the youth are important to this movement. We have to fight together in a united coalition way.
So what are you doing next year?
I want to explore my options of going to Pasadena City College or Morehouse in Atlanta and further the movement, build college campuses, because those college students in UC Berkeley and UCLA and all these other University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, like those students all over the country are fighting, but they need to know how to fight better and fight more powerful, united with it. With those college students, I'm willing to miss a few classes to go to those surrounding high schools and get those youth involved with the action, because you got to go to a college. I made it. You need to make it, too. You're going to college, too. You need to come and join these guys. Both high school, college, middle school, elementary school students need to get involved.
What would you say to a student who wants to get involved? What would you say they should do? What's the first step?
Well, I just think saying the truth, the plain truth about what's going on. What I learned in BAM was to tell the truth and nothing but the truth. You have to be trusted, and you got to tell the truth. So you got to tell the story of the old civil rights movement and how the Little Rock Nine were youth high school students. The four little girls in the Birmingham church bombing were little girls releasing dogs on youth. The youth were very important in the civil rights movement. And after King died, the civil rights movement dispersed also. But there's a new upcoming, and BAM is it, and BAM is getting ready to explode, and we're getting bigger and bigger and fighting, and we're going to keep fighting.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with student organizer Tabrin Joe. To learn more about BAM and how to get involved, visit bamn.ueaa.net. You're listening to Education Radio. We'll continue after a short break.
Yet our best trained, best educated, best equipped, best prepared troops refuse to fight. Matter of fact, it's safe to say that they would rather switch than fight.
Getting fail us. You say, what is this? My beloved, let's get down to business. Mental self-defense or fitness. The rest the show.
You got to go to what you know.
To make everybody see. In order to fight the powers that be. Fight the power. Fight the power. Fight the power.
Welcome back to Education Radio. Today we were listening to voices from the Save Our Schools conference that took place in Washington, D.C. in July. This conference brought together hundreds of teachers, education scholars, youth, and activists from all over the country for 2 days of workshops and networking as a means to build a national movement to restore educator, parent, student, and community influence over education policy and practice.
Next, we hear from Sabrina Stevens-Shoup, the Public Relations Coordinator for Save Our Schools. Sabrina was an elementary school teacher in Denver Public Schools until she was pushed out of that position for putting her students' learning before her school's demands for reform and testing. Tim Scott talked with Sabrina about her story.
So you were teaching what grades?
I taught fourth and fifth.
How long?
2 years in Denver, and then all the rest of my teaching experience has been extracurricular and summertime. So I spent 2 years in Denver Public Schools.
And your decision to leave?
So it was a lot of things. It was exhausting. It was working in an environment that was unethical. So we were being told to do things that we knew weren't right for our students. A lot of people would just go along with it. That's not who I am. And so I'm fortunate enough that, you know, I don't have kids in the mortgage. And so I could stand up to a principal in a situation where most people aren't willing to because they don't want to risk their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, we had a lot of things going on that I would just ask questions like, why would we do that when we could do this? First, very naively, I kind of came into the situation like, oh, everyone's, you know, wants it. And everybody talks a good game in this realm about we want to put the students first and we want to, you know, make sure everyone can overcome, you know, low achievement and all this other kind of stuff. And so I, you know, assuming we're all working on that same team and on that same framework, just be like, well, wait a minute, the research doesn't support us doing this, and we're trying to raise students' achievement. And so finally it became this thing where I was just the kind of the thorn in my principal's side, because when I would speak about these things and I would be able to say, well, I know that doesn't make any sense, and other teachers were listening, one. And so he was, you know, that puts him in a tough situation because he's got to show whatever numbers to his boss in the district who doesn't know education and all this other kind of stuff. And so here is this teacher who's asking too many questions. And so he would always say, you just got to learn how to play the game. We just got to stay, you know, they were trying to avoid NCLB sanctions and all those kinds of things. And to me, I'm like, I'm not here for a job. I'm here to do something. And so I don't believe in just playing along and that sort of thing, if it's a choice. Like, I originally tried to just do everything, and then I collapsed. I'm like, okay, well, I can't do everything, so I'm going to do what matters. And that put me at odds with my administration. So one of the teachers I was collaborating with, they actually had a... He was very deliberate in trying to keep new teachers and veteran teachers separate and kind of keep us in a little bit of antagonism with each other, because the veteran teachers, it turns out, had a lot of experience about, you know, because these reforms tend to be cyclical. So these sort of quick fixes that, oh, we're going to just do this program and it's going to raise everybody's test scores and save the world, all this stuff had been done before and it had all failed. And so they knew that. As young teachers, you know, they're banking on us not having that historical knowledge and just going along with the program so that they can had their own resumes. Well, I tried this, 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 and this to improve achievement. And so I started working with one of the veteran teachers to kind of figure out what's going to be our alternative plan, because we can't just complain about this. We know it's not working, and we don't want to be those people who just sit in the teacher's lounge and bitch. So what are we going to do? What's our alternative to this so that we can actually meet the students' needs in a way that makes sense? So we started working together, and it just, again, a very friendly on our own time, you know, we became very good friends, but it became this whole, like, subversive thing that the principal really felt he needed to shut down. So she had tenure, I didn't, so due process rates. So they put her through this really bogus remediation plan. She did every single thing they asked of her, and they still came back at the end and were like, nope, not good enough, you're fired. Or we're going to recommend you for dismissal. They obviously have to have a hearing after that. And she was completely redeemed during that process, but they're still trying to give her problems at the district. Mm-hmm. But at the end of that remediation process, they perp walked this woman out of the building like she was a criminal. And so not only did she do everything that was asked of her, but even if she had been a bad teacher, the level of disrespect of being escorted out of the building by a security officer and an HR person as though you committed a crime, to me was just so disgusting. And so that was March of the last school year. And so I was just like, that's it. That was my last straw. And so I submitted my resignation effective at the end of the school year, because I was like, I'm not going to work in an environment like that. I want to take a year off from the classroom, figure out, you know, how I can do this and still be effective for students and that sort of thing. And then a month later, I get my evaluation, my end of year evaluation stuff back, and all my scores are really good, and there's all these catty comments. And so I'm like, what's this about? So we have to have a meeting about it. So, my meeting, I kind of fill this table with all this, evidence that refutes all the stuff that had been said. And again, the principal steps in, he's like, you know what, no one's disputing that you're a good teacher, but you need to learn how to play this game. And so finally at this point, it's towards the end of the year, I'm sick to death of hearing this. I've seen this person, behave, and I'm not planning on coming back. So I said, you know what, I understand I'm probably a difficult person for you to have on staff because you answer to people and only see numbers, but I have to look these kids in the eye every day, and I have to be accountable to them and to their best interests. And so I'm not going to compromise on that to make you or me more comfortable. And so he's like, no, shuts it down. We're just going to have to agree to disagree. Next day, I get called to the principal's office. First time in my life, I was always a goody-goody in school. First time I get called to the principal's office, I was a teacher. And so I'm like, okay, so what's going on? And he's like, well, you're going to be non-renewed for cause. And I was like, what does that mean? So he's like, we're non-renewing your contract. And I was like, I already ended my contract as of the end of the school year. I resigned. Well, there's a technicality, there's something wrong with it, so we're rejecting your resignation and we're doing this instead. And so I'm like, okay, so what does that mean? And it's like, well, after this year, if this goes through, you will be ineligible for rehire in this district. And so I'm like, wait a minute, so I'm being banned from ever working in Denver Public Schools? And he's like, yes. I'm like trying to, compute all this stuff, like I already tried to leave, like what are you doing? And so then I'm like, well, it says for cause, what's the cause? You're being non-renewed for cause. And so we go back and forth literally for like 2 straight minutes of him just saying you're being non-renewed for cause. To this day, they've not even bothered to make up a cause.
In union language, it's just cause.
Just cause, right. Exactly. And so the joke around school has become, just cause. Colorado's right to work state, so we have weak unions. We don't have, we have very weak worker protections overall. And so even though in the statute you're supposed to provide some sort of a, if you say that, you're supposed to provide a reason, they haven't even bothered to make one up. And, I recognize that I would have to fight a costly legal battle I couldn't afford. It would be very time-consuming to try and force them to at least come up with a cause, let alone actually overturning the decision. And so I became, decided rather than go through all that, I'm just going to tell this story and I'm going to look for other people and see what's going on in those places. Because to me, that's the bigger problem, is that we're in a situation that is stacked against people doing the right thing.
Sounds like it was very demoralizing for you, mm-hmm. and not only your experience, but what you saw going on around you,
right.
especially with this other teacher.
Right.
Would you say that pattern fits into this larger assault on teachers, mm-hmm. and that the expectation, as you experienced firsthand, is that teachers are being required to be obedient,
right?
Which essentially means eliminating union rights,
right?
As well as any agency you have in your classrooms, right, and relationships you have with your students.
Absolutely. First of all, I think this whole push to eliminate quote-unquote tenure, which is inaccurate. When teachers don't get tenure, they get due process, because what ends up happening is, for example, my friend, you know, got to go before a judge. The district presented their evidence, she presented her evidence, and their case was shot full of holes, and they were ordered to reinstate her. They're taking their sweet time on that, and it's a shame. But bottom line is, with her, they actually had to go through that process to prove what they wanted to, because ultimately you want to get rid of older teachers because they're more expensive. They don't want to pay pensions. But so, then this whole push to have young, dispensable teachers is that, in my case, there was no expense in terms of just being able to be like, oh, you know, you don't have any rights, so goodbye. That is really the danger here. And that's what's really, you know, that's what we see happening, is that you can just, if your entire teacher corps has no rights, then you don't have to prove that you're getting rid of them because they're ineffective. You can just get rid of them. And so if you're trying to cut budgets, if you're trying to squash dissent, whatever it is that you're doing, you don't have to prove that you have a good reason for doing it. And that's the danger we're in right now, is that we're, you know, states that are eliminating due process rights for teachers across the board are setting people up to be in the Senate situation that I found myself in, and that a lot of teachers find themselves in, because as I found in the course of my work this past year, there's a ton of us who've been in this very same position.
Mm-hmm. Now you're working with Save Our Schools, mm-hmm. SOS, and despite your demoralizing experience as a teacher, you're committed to public education.
Absolutely.
Can you tell me more about that?
Well, to me, one, I think, you know, we don't have a choice. Public education is, aside from our media marketplace, it's the largest shared experience we all have. And so if we don't have strong public schools, we will not have a strong society. Like, it's just not possible. And so we need to, you know, there's obviously lots of things that need to be improved in education, and we're ready to improve those things, but foundationally we need to make sure we're putting people in a situation that allows them to do that. We need to make sure that we're listening to the people who know the most about learning in order to create good learning experiences for children. We need to make sure that we've got, because I think I'm a person who believes in the power of the situation. A lot of people want to locate all the problems in the person, but there are definitely some unethical individuals, for example, working in Denver Public Schools. My principal was an unethical person. But I see this happening in a lot of other places, and it's because schools are strapped for cash. They're making these choices because they feel like they don't know what else they can do. And so I think, looking at the bigger picture, we're putting too many people in a situation where it's so tempting to cheat on a test, where it's so tempting to, because you're looking at it where I have a mortgage and I have kids to whom I'm responsible. I was able to take my strong stand because I ultimately didn't have to worry about that. But a lot of people don't have that luxury. And so we need to make sure that we're putting people, that's not even on the table. Because to me, I feel like that's an impossible choice to ask someone to choose between their own kids and their students.
Mm-hmm. So where do you go from here, you personally, as well as within this movement?
Well, I think for us as a movement, it's more of us coming together and seeing, you know, this is what, you know, both what we don't like and this is what we want to see instead. And I think that work looks different. You know, there's going to be those of us who run for school board. There's going to be those of us who go work for our unions. There's going to be those of us who stay in the classroom and, you know, continue to try to fight the good fight. There's going to be, you know, parents and teachers coming together to lobby for bills that increase education funding, that, you know, create better teacher evaluation systems, or rather that allow teachers to evaluate, you know, each other, as opposed to legislatures evaluating teachers, because that's inappropriate. So there's all these different, you know, things that are going on already and are going to continue to happen under this banner. I feel like for me personally, you know, ultimately I kind of see myself as fighting for this, you know, to be able to do what I was doing in my classroom and not have it be a crime. You know, so I want to be able to go back and teach fourth grade in an inner city classroom and not be questioned for writing books with my students, and not be questioned for, you know, having them read real literature as opposed to these basal readers, and not be questioned for not reading from the script. To me, that's what it's all about, is just making it so that, you know, teachers can teach and students can learn, and not have to worry about all this other nonsense.
Mm. So what experiences and learning has contributed most to your current perspective and taking action?
I think a lot of what I, you know, learned in college and that sort of thing is definitely a part of it. But I think just, you know, sort of seeing what happens, seeing the differences in the differences between what I experience, what I know kids experience in inner city classrooms, the differences between what I was taught to do for the children of wealthy and powerful people versus what I was asked to do for the children of the poor. Just seeing those things, experiencing those things is really what shaped me the most, because, I mean, I had no consciousness of this stuff growing up. And so there's is this explicit learning that went on in college about here's what happens. Reading, people like Jonathan Kozol and all these people I get to meet this weekend, which is so incredible. But, really it's more those experiences of when you're actually there firsthand and you just see daily just crimes committed against kids. I think that's a crime. They're not getting equal protection. They're not being provided for equally at all. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been the most important thing, is just the direct experience.
Are there moments in your life, or maybe one big moment, that changed the direction you were going to take in your life?
To become a teacher?
To become a teacher, and maybe then as a activist teacher.
Mm-hmm. Well, for me, I think it was when I realized that there were these differences. I didn't intend to be a teacher growing up. I took my sort of intro to education studies course at Swarthmore because I needed to fulfill a distribution requirement. And I just, stumbled on all this knowledge of, because you don't go to other school systems and stuff when you're growing up. Usually you kind of assume what I'm getting is what everybody's getting. And so reading Savage Inequalities, reading The Power of Their Ideas, and thinking about just how much less, and I knew my parents had moved us out of New York for the schools, but I never really thought to ask them about that. Well, what did you see that was wrong? And that sort of thing. And so for me, it was I've always kind of been an advocate by nature. I always stood up for kids who were being bullied. So to me, it was I always had that inclination to make a difference. And then it was teaching is a really powerful way to do that, because if we see that schools have become these sites of social reproduction where, kids of the wealthy get trained to take on their parents' roles and the kids of the poor get trained to take their parents' roles, the best way to disrupt that is to have people go into the classroom and subvert those ideas.
Which isn't new.
Exactly. And so again, and for me, I kind of originally thought, well, we have a lot of people writing about this. I'm sitting here in college reading all these people who are saying all this stuff. And so at first I thought maybe I might want to be, a professor or whatever else. But then I was no, we just need people to go do this. And so that's why I wanted to go into the classroom. So that was my motivation, I guess. But again, it's, then you find out that, there's a reason why there's not that many people doing that in schools. It's because you get pushed out.
Yeah.
Right now, I'm actively working on a contract with DCTA, which is the local teachers union there. It's trying to rebuild. And then I'm working with a school board candidate. I'm trying to get reelected because our school board's really under attack by a lot of these forces, people who are really trying to push this agenda on schools.
What are these forces?
In Denver, it's a democratic, in terms of the party place, but definitely has a lot of really neoliberal ideas about we're going to, just markets and education, markets will solve everything kind of orientation. So, very, very Arnie-friendly country in terms of the people who are in power there, but the community is very much more of an SOS orientation. And so we have that fact, three versus four on our school board of, the four who've been, kind of bought and paid for by DFER, Stanford Children, Gates Foundation, Broad Foundation, Walton Family. And then we have our three, kind of community fighters who are really trying to at least get one more seat so that we can, a lot of these policies, for example, if we had four seats on that school board, I would still be teaching in Denver, or at least eligible to teach in Denver, because they would have been able to supersede that judgment of that principal. So things so that's, kind of where we're doing, fighting those battles.
So it's ideologically driven?
Absolutely ideologically driven, yeah. Because, the evidence just isn't there to support any of this.
What is your feeling about the significance of this conference, the SOS conference here in Washington, D.C., and the following March?
I think the significance of it, one, is just, even as late as last year, you have Arne Duncan going around saying, there's no opposition to my policy. No, that's not true. So I think the significance really is, one, showing that, there are many of us who disagree with the direction of education policy in this country and are committed to improving schools in a way that makes sense, in a way that's actually effective. I think just in terms of I think it's a model for how to, you know, keep things like this, you know, sustaining movements to effectively counterbalance this, you know, I think juggernaut was used today. Mm-hmm. So, you know, having a place where people can come together and break down those silos, as Rick said, you know, so people are sharing their different areas of expertise, they're making those connections, they're connecting those dots. And so there's that piece of it, the education piece of get informed, hone a skill set that you can use to be active on these issues. I think in terms of the rally, again, just as a demonstration that there is something going on here. Last year, actually the first time I met Jesse and Bess, when I had, you know, I'd started to follow Jesse when he was walking through New Jersey, and then I kind of, you know, stopped, visited family, came back to visit in Maryland. Jesse Turner, mm-hmm. He was walking to D.C. First time we met, we had hosted an event, and it ended up just being the three of us in an empty room. And then the next time we went to an event, there were 10 people. And the next time we went to an event, there were 40 people. And then we came to America, and it was like 40 people. And to go from that to thousands of people showing their support for a march just a year later, I think this is really incredible that, you know, this awakening is happening among people that something's really seriously wrong in our schools and in our society, and we're committed to doing something about it. And so it's just, I think that's the real power of it, is that these numbers keep growing, and the people who are willing to speak out and say that we're going to do something differently, both here in D.C., the people who are doing things online, the people who are doing flash mobs, the people who are hosting Main Street mm-hmm. parades, and mm-hmm. all these things that are happening just this weekend alone. I think it's just, it's a powerful message to send that for folks who are thinking, I wasn't comfortable, you know, spending this much of my time preparing my students for tests, or I'm not comfortable, really, with my kids bringing home all these worksheets. Just letting them know this is a bigger thing.
Right. And feeling that way in isolation.
Exactly. Yes. This is not just happening to you. You're not crazy because you're the only teacher in your building who doesn't think you should just go along with that. And so I think that's really the big piece, is just raising that awareness that this is going on all over the place and it doesn't have to be.
Great. The significance of this event as far as a step in movement building
right.
is powerful, because from my understanding, there hasn't been an event like this before, a
right.
conference and a march, to not only save public education,
right.
but be able to nurture it, to ensure that universal public education lives up to its potential,
right.
which it never has.
Right.
But there are many reform movements that right. were moving it to live up to its potential.
Right.
Was never reached, and it was hijacked.
Right, absolutely.
30 years ago, more than that. But.
I think that's exactly right. Because, again, we're all on the page of, like, you know, there's nobody here who's saying, oh, yeah, unequal outcomes for students, that's cool. You know, nobody's, you know, and I think that's the piece that, you know, the sort of reform types try to make it, like, this conversation between, you know, the reformers, like Michelle Ring, and then this anonymous mass of, yeah, union members who just care about their jobs. And everybody, they're just defending the status quo. Like, that kind of brush off. Just stop thinking, because if you're not with us, you're against us. And so I think these are all people who are perfectly willing to start talking about how schools stratify students according to class and all these different things. And these are the types of educators, too, who work to subvert that. So we're not saying things need to stay the way they are. We're saying we want to make sure, one, that they stay public, because this is a really scary time where we really are considering. It was never on the table to privatize education in an explicit way. It is on the table now. So we're saying we absolutely have to improve schools. But first and foremost, we need to make sure that the basics are covered. They need to be public. They need to be open to all. They need to be funded. We need to have real teachers in every classroom, not interns. Mm-hmm. And so that's really what this is about. We want to make sure that accountability needs to start at the top. If you've got all this control and you've got this power and things like that, you need to be doing your job in order for us to be able to do ours. And so I think that's really kind of the piece of it, is we're saying, yeah, obviously, we're going to improve things in schools. We want to keep making them better. They always have to shift with what's going on in our society. But we also need to make sure that we've got those basics covered, because we haven't ever funded schools equitably. We haven't ever made sure that poor kids had access to the same high-quality curriculum, highly effective, you know, or trained and qualified teachers. We've never made that an explicit priority. The closest we got was an NCLB saying a highly qualified teacher's got to be in every classroom, and they gutted that. So, I mean, the one good thing to come out of that legislation, and then that was one of the first things to go. So, I mean, that's really what we're saying, is that don't declare our schools a failure without giving them a chance.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Sabrina Stephen-Shoup, the public relations coordinator for Save Our Schools and former Denver Public Schools teacher. You can hear more from Sabrina by visiting her blog, www.sabrinastephenshoup.com, where she writes about education reform. Next week on Education Radio, we hear from education historian and former Assistant Secretary of Education, Diane Ravitch, a one-time conservative education reform leader and supporter of No Child Left Behind, who has since transformed into a staunch opponent of high-stakes testing, charter schools, and school privatization. You have been listening to Education Radio. Today's episode has been produced by the Education Radio Collective. Visit us on our blog, education-radio.blogspot.com.